Good afternoon and welcome to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. In this hour, we look deeper into the scandals that led into the economic meltdowns. Then, what can the history of human rights tell us about the struggles of today? Finally, on the Scholar's Circle, historical memory as a battlefield, how some memory entrepreneurs are rewriting history to shape the policies of the future. While the recklessness of the large banks and financial regulators has been largely exposed both by the Financial Inquiry Commission and diligent observers alike, our next guest says there are still some elements that need to be exposed, including the role of particular individuals, such as the one at the head of Fannie Mae, who was enriching himself while encouraging home ownership. Gretchen Morgenson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who writes for the New York Times. Her new book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon, looks beyond the commission and details the activities of a number of the individuals and their roles in the meltdown. Welcome, Gretchen Morgenson.
Thank you for having me.
You went back to Bill Clinton's days, and you noted he had this effort to make home ownership more available and affordable. It was really a good goal, but it went awry with this partnership. Tell us what originally he was trying to do, what he created, and why it went badly.
You know, the reason that my co-author Josh Rosner and I felt that we had to go back further in time than a lot of the other financial crisis books had done was because this is such an enormous crisis and so deep and has really injured so many people that we really knew that it could not have occurred overnight. It really didn't happen quickly. And so the groundwork was laid many, many years ago. And it really started actually in the early 90s, but there was this push by Bill Clinton and the home building industry and the housing finance industry and all of the various companies that are interested in home building that touch home building. And they were all working together in what was a unique public-private partnership where the government, regulators, and private industry were joining hands to encourage home ownership, to really increase the rate of home ownership, which had been stagnant for several years. It was a lofty goal. It was an idea where you would expand home ownership, which had been an American dream. The idea was to expand home ownership to include people who had not been typically able to buy a house, whether it were lower income people, first time home buyers, and also immigrants.
So he created this partnership that really teamed up both the regulators and the regulated. And it sounds like it was really we can all work together to make this work, but it really went awry.
What happened was by encouraging this push for home ownership and by really joining hands between regulators and the regulated entities, in many cases, especially the financial institutions, what basically was encouraged was this anything-goes attitude towards lending. There had been a top-down directive. We want to increase homeownership. We want to expand it to people who had not been able to secure a home before. And what that meant was whatever you have to do to make that happen, we're on your side. Now, the government didn't say go and make loans to people that can't afford to repay them, which is actually what happened. The government didn't say to Countrywide Financial, go and make poisonous loans and toxic loans that are so costly that people will never be able to repay them. But that was, in essence, what happened at the end of the line. And so while you cannot say that Bill Clinton created the crisis, there was this sense that there was a new directive to promote home ownership, and private industry took the idea and ran with it, and it became, unfortunately, a race to the bottom.
You've called these companies that were involved, like Novastar and Countrywide, drug pushers in a schoolyard, and the ratings agencies, you called them like narcotics cops looking the other way.
Well, you've had a lot of different parties involved here. There is plenty of blame to go around. You had, of course, the lenders who were reckless, the lenders who were levying enormous fees and charges on these loans, and they didn't care about whether or not they would be repaid because they were selling them to Wall Street, who was in turn selling them to investors. In the old days, a bank would make a loan, and the bank would hope that it would be repaid. The bank would hold on to the loan and therefore had the risk, carried the risk of it not being repaid on its books. That meant they had an incentive to make sure that the borrower had the money to pay it back. Well, that all went out the window during this process because this was a machinery that was set up simply to generate loans to sell to someone else. And it turned out that those someone else's were people who were not paying attention. They were relying on the ratings agencies to analyze the loans, and they were really ended up suffering enormous losses because they were not vigilant.
You spend a lot of time with the quasi-government, quasi-private organizations like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Can you give us an overview of these companies and the people involved?
Well, Fannie Mae was a company that was started in the Great Depression in 1938. It was a government agency at that time that was created to help borrowers get access to mortgages. It was not a finance company itself, i.e. it was not a bank. It did not lend money. But what it did was it would guarantee loans that other institutions made, and it would also buy loans that other institutions made. So it was sort of a facilitator, and it was designed in the Depression to alleviate the problem where borrowers could not get access to money for their homes. Well, when you fast forward to the 1960s, Fannie Mae becomes a private company with shareholders, raises stock in the public, and it becomes a company that has to generate substantial earnings that investors buy the stock hoping to see it go up. And that was a completely different setup from strictly a government agency. So at that point in time, it became a quasi-government agency, but with private shareholders. Suddenly, the urge to make a profit was much more important than it had been previously. And as we argue in the book, in 1991, the fellow who took over the reins as chief executive officer, a guy by the name of James Johnson, really started to put the company on steroids. It became super profitable. It was all about generating profits for the stockholders and to generate huge paychecks for the top-ranking insiders of the company. And it was incredibly important at that time for the company to maintain its government relationship because that gave it a huge and lucrative edge against any other financial institution.
You and others have rightfully pointed out the errors of Goldman Sachs in particular. Reconnect their role and how they began this betting against the very loans that they were peddling.
Well, Goldman Sachs is an integral player in the years leading up to the crisis and also in the crisis. James Johnson, the man that I just mentioned, who was the CEO of Fannie Mae from 1991 to 1998 and then in 99 became vice chairman, he was really on the scene at the company when it ballooned its balance sheet, when it grew very, very large, and also at the end of that period when it started to have accounting irregularities. It was not accounting properly on its books. So he immediately joined the board of Goldman Sachs as soon as he left Fannie Mae. A former top executive of Goldman had been on Fannie Mae's board. And at one point in time, Goldman Sachs even helped Fannie Mae to manipulate its earnings, to make its earnings look better than they actually were, as government investigators found. So there was a close relationship between Goldman Sachs and Fannie Mae in the years leading up to the crisis. And then when the crisis erupted, it all became very evident to Congress and to other investigators that Goldman Sachs had been designing or helping to design securities that it allowed it to bet against the mortgage market, even as it was selling those securities to its customers as instruments that they said would be good, money good for those customers. So they were betting against their own clients.
And what about companies like Fremont Investment and Loan?
Well, Fremont was just one of many freewheeling lenders like Countrywide. Fremont was not as big as Countrywide, but it was a venerable California company. It did a tremendous amount of subprime loans, and Goldman Sachs was its chief enabler. Goldman was the company that gave Fremont the money that it needed to continue to make these loans. As you know, in the mania when mortgages were being made like crazy, these companies didn't have huge amounts of capital of their own. They needed what was called a warehouse line of credit from a bank or another institution that would allow them to kind of keep making these loans. It's almost like a factory. What was interesting was that Fremont had had a very serious, significant run-in with insurance regulators in California during the period leading up to the crisis, and yet nobody seemed to pay attention. This company, which really drove its insurance subsidiary into the ground, nobody seemed to worry that its business practices might be questionable. And yet it turned out to be precisely that. The loans that they made were extremely dubious and produced millions of losses.
Some people have argued that these ratings agencies, which were key in this because they were giving these loans, these mortgages, high ratings, some believe that it was the way they were paid. In other words, they were being paid by the sellers of the securities, not the buyers, mm-hmm. and that this conflict of interest was part of the problem. What do you think was going on?
I think there were several things going on. One, they certainly enjoyed the very, very lucrative nature of this business. When ratings agencies would analyze a mortgage pool, a security that was made up of thousands of mortgages, they would receive far, far more money from the company that was issuing it than they would if they were analyzing, say, a corporate bond, for example. They would receive multiples of the amount of money on a mortgage-backed security. And so they had an incentive to keep rating them and to keep wanting them to be generated. So that was for starters. But there was also, I think, an element of incompetence. I think that they had not kept up with some of the practices on Wall Street. And they were also ignorant about the quality of the loans that were in these pools. They really didn't take a sharp pencil to these loans to look at the kind of borrower that we were talking about, what the FICO score was, what the geographic mix of the loans in the pools was. They weren't doing their due diligence.
Now, what about people involved in the government side? Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, where were they in all this?
Well, Tim Geithner is an interesting one because he was very involved as president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. He was supposed to be overseeing Citigroup, for example. And Citigroup, as we all know, got into huge trouble, required three different bailouts during the height of the crisis. He would make arguments that risk had been actually reduced by certain innovations on Wall Street. Well, that proved to be completely incorrect. The risk had been hidden from view. It really was, I think, a pretty dismal performance by Mr. Geithner, and yet now he is the Treasury Secretary.
And Ben Bernanke?
Well, Mr. Bernanke was not the chief culprit behind the Federal Reserve's problem decisions during the years of the mania. That was Alan Greenspan, and he was really responsible for keeping interest rates far too low for far too long, and that really encouraged the lending frenzy that we experienced because interest rates really should not have been as low as they were. He also was dialectically opposed to consumer oversight, didn't really care about consumers and how they were treated by financial institutions. He was more interested in the esoteric money supply, monetary policy, those kind of bigger picture structural approaches.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson at the time told Congress everything was going to be fine. He was sort of personally invested, wasn't he?
Well, he had come, of course, from Goldman Sachs. He was the chief executive officer. He seemed relatively unprepared and ill-equipped. I guess didn't really have a playbook. We had Bear Stearns fail in March of 2008. Then there was a six-month period of relative quiet when the government could have been doing something to make sure that further problems were not blossoming, to make sure that companies that were perhaps imperiled were getting their house in order. But there didn't really seem to be any concerted effort by the government to do so. And so then in September of 2008, we had the thing really just explode into a million pieces, and we had Lehman fail and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac taken over by the taxpayer and AIG, which then became default.
Let's fast forward a bit now. We had the Financial Inquiry Commission hold hearings. They put out their report. What is your assessment of that particular commission, and what have we seen come of it since then?
Well, we've seen very little come of it. I think the FCIC, it had some decent hearings. There were some interesting things that came out of it, but it really didn't generate a lot of new information. I was disappointed in it. For instance, I had covered Countrywide extensively in the New York Times, and there was very little new in the Countrywide investigation under the FCIC. In fact, one of the investigators told us that Countrywide had been said to be off limits by the head of the commissions and the top managers of the commission. And that was certainly a company that was ground zero in the reckless lending that was going on.
Now, the commission was specifically told not to recommend policy. But have we seen change either within the regulatory bodies emerging that would make substantive difference from Congress, President's office?
You had the Dodd-Frank bill, right, which became law and which basically required regulators to write almost 400 new laws to try to prevent a crisis like this from happening again. The big financial institutions are arguing strenuously and lobbying very hard to keep the new regulations from really doing anything that can damage their business. For instance, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and the major financial regulators want there to be more due diligence done in mortgages, want there to be more safe mortgages written rather than unsafe and reckless ones. And so they've made these requirements where you might have to have a down payment of 20%, for instance, to be considered a safe loan. The debt amount, the interest that has to be paid, could not exceed a certain amount of a borrower's income. So these are the kinds of things that regulators want to put in place so that there won't be these kinds of loans that can't be repaid. And yet at the same time, the bankers are arguing strenuously and are really, really pushing back against them.
I think the final place to connect the dots would be the relationship to this mess with what is happening all over Europe, for example, with the financial collapses. Can you connect those dots for our listeners?
Unfortunately, the collapse of the mortgage securities that were underwritten during this period has really had a very, very expansive effect. European banks bought many, many of these securities. This was a big export business for the United States. Unfortunately, it was exporting toxic waste, really, badly underwritten mortgages. And it's unfortunate because a lot of foreign financial institutions purchased them, and now they're experiencing losses as a result. I'm not saying that that's every piece of the puzzle as far as Europe is concerned. Obviously, in many countries in Europe, they simply do not have enough revenues coming in to cover their costs, as is the case in Greece, apparently Italy, Spain. So you have income not exceeding the outflow, and that, of course, is untenable. But the American export of toxic mortgage securities didn't help matters.
Well, thank you, Gretchen Morgenson. The name of the book, again, is Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. Human rights are rights held by individuals simply because they are human, says our next guest. The idea of human rights stretches back throughout the history of humanity, but it was 1948 when the United Nations reached to the values articulated in the French Revolution to codify the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. But throughout history, each advance for human rights was followed by severe setbacks. One wave of advances grew from the Bolshevik Revolution, the League of Nations, and the International Labor Organization, but they were crushed by Stalinism and fascism. Now we are entering another phase that is rife with challenges marked by globalism, market imperatives, and post-9/11 security concerns. What can we learn from the history of human rights? We're joined now by Micheline Ishay. She is professor and director of the International Human Rights Program at the University of Denver. Her book is called The History of Human Rights, From Ancient Times to the Era of Globalization. She's also the editor of the Human Rights Reader. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us, Micheline.
Thank you. Likewise.
So, you know what I'd like to start with is I wonder if you could give us kind of an overview in terms of the big contributions. And you went through a lot of them in your book, so maybe focus on the ones that were the greatest gains of where these ideas of human rights came from.
Well, it's interesting because you were talking just at the beginning about the various components that moved human rights forward and some that might have yielded to a backlash or a setback. And for instance, if you think about capitalism, on the one hand, it opened new opportunities for individuals. It created, for instance, the possibility for individuals to claim the right to property against the estate of the nobility. It enables individuals to say, I want also the possibility to participate in the political forum in which I reside. So capitalism, in a way, and the Enlightenment opened an enormous amount of room for individuals to claim rights that did not exist under feudalism. At the same time, as we arrive to the 19th century, we see the excess of the accumulations of property rights and a new movement which will try to just target on a new agenda of rights, mainly on economic and social rights, suggesting that they are disenfranchised, that they are not able to shrink the economic gaps that exist between those who have and those will unleash a battle throughout the 19th century to claim the right to vote and also to have some form of economic safety net to secure their basic human rights. So here we see throughout two centuries the development of a host of rights, civil, political, and economic rights. And by the time you arrive in the 20th century, as an effort to break colonial empires, we will see the erection of new countries who will actually ask for their right to self-determination and their cultural rights. So in effect, those are the great trends that will be later encoded in the various bills of rights, starting from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, and then the Covenant of Civil and Political Rights and Covenant of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 1966. So that's sort of, I'm canvassing for you sort of in a broad terms, the main visions of rights throughout the last 300 years.
And so, and then when you bring it fast-forwarding to today and the issues that we're facing today with globalization, with the fight against terrorism, you talk about the challenges that we're facing there, including kind of this global consumerism, what you called a shrinking social space. So I wonder if you could address these two things and talk about the kind of contradictions that come up with these issues.
Mm-hmm. You can see contradictions in the Janus face of globalization. So on the one hand, a possibility to connect with individuals across boundaries that is available as a result of the advance of information technology, and as a result of some form of economic integration. This enable individuals to transcend their parochialism, some individuals to ask for rights that they didn't even know that exist in countries where there is higher repressions of rights. At the same time, globalization erodes traditional loyalties, indigenous culture, might enable investment and open market, but at the same time, erodes also environmental protection in areas where states are weak. So we have an array of problems that come along with globalization, just as some of the benefits.
And this idea of the shrinking social space.
What is interesting is we are in a world in which consumerism has taken over the public space, the physical public space, the place where individuals used to rally and just demand changes to their governments or defeat government's policy. The rally, the public sphere, is no longer what it used to be in the golden age of the 19th century. So with the age of consumerism, people can actually isolate themselves in their household and trying to intervene via the internet or think that they have a capacity of intervention just by watching their television. But it's become shrunk in the sense that it's given illusions that we can reach beyond us to space that we were never able to reach initially, but at the same time we physically have less that capacity to speak with each other in order to make a substantial change. And that's one of the concerns when we are talking about change and human rights struggle. Who is heard? Institutions, international institutions, are surrogates for those who and lend themselves to the voice that are unheard. But often they forget to represent also the voice that are unheard in that process.
Right. And you also talked about the kind of the phenomena of a rising search for an escape from the characteristics of globalism. And in particular, you talk about people kind of trying to decentralize, escaping into their churches, their mosques. But the other side of that is that there is kind of a fundamentalism that has been growing.
Yes, this is one of the aspects that is troublesome from a human rights perspective. The mosque, the temples, and other religious sites provide a more personable place for people to connect with each other. And so there is, to some extent, a return to those sites. People want community, and religious forums provide often that substitute for the more secular community that is in disappearance. The problem is that in places where governments are weak or almost non-existent and where civil society is fragile, often we see the religious centers to become the vehicle to reclaim the voice for people. The universalist aspect of human rights is lost. Many of those religious sites, particularly in the poor countries, are concerned about poverty. They are not universalistic in the human rights sense. There is still discrimination between men and women, and that is, to some extent...
Micheline Ishe, I'd like for you to connect this now with some of the things that you showed historically. For example, you said that some of the kind of bad human rights violations of the past, like from the Industrial Revolution, really spawned new sites for human interaction and forms of resistance. And bring that fast forward to today.
It's true that in a way, in that tale of two cities, where you have cities which actually have concentrated during the Industrial Revolution, poor people who are working in factories, at the same time, those areas become forums for communication. People, as a result of that, are succeeding to developing agenda, political programs, and make demands, developing collective bargaining in a way that was not done and possible when those people lived in the agrarian and feudal site.
It sounded like what you were saying is that with each of these problems that were massive human rights abuses actually created simultaneously opportunities.
True. But those opportunities are not created by themselves. So, yes, history is filled with contradictions, and people can seize those contradictions, though those contradictions may be left to the whims of the visible hand. One needs to seize them and channel forces in directions that are fruitful and beneficial for human rights. Whether the new sites today, the shrinking space of the religious community could become those sites for progressive politics, I think that in a way it is the case if we make it happen.
Well, Micheline Ishe, thank you so much for being with us. This has been just really wonderful having you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
When we come back, historical memory as a battleground, how memory entrepreneurs are rewriting history to shape the policies of the future. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. How people remember historical events helps to shape the future of the world, say scholars. Some facts, for example, may be conveniently dropped, or information may be framed in a way that creates a different mythological memory of the past. In this way, memory is itself a battlefield where competing narratives seek to become the official ones, and then they affect the politics and policies of the future. Several scholars have begun to study what they call memory entrepreneurs and how those entrepreneurs use historical memory to forward their political agendas. We have with us Douglas Becker. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, and he covers a wide range of topics, varying from the prosecution of war crimes, United Nations, conflict resolution, international law. We have with us Alex Hinton. He is executive director at the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He's a professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and the first vice president, the International Association of Genocide Scholars. Davila Budrete also joins us. She is professor of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College. She studies democratization, gender studies, and nationalism. And we have with us Brent Sasley, professor of political science at University of Texas at Arlington, who focuses on international relations theory, foreign policy of the Middle East, and the role of emotions in foreign policy process. Doug Becker, I want to begin with you. You have said that history does not exist so much in the past as in the present. What do you mean by that?
Well, the study of history and specifically of historical memory is as much a study of the present as it is the past. History has profound implications for present and as well as future social, political, cultural implications. In many ways, the way that history gets filtered through contemporary political issues by contemporary political actors, it has these profound implications. It can be wielded as a weapon by different political activists. It could be used to create certain stories that justify policies, and it can be used as a wonderful tool to define communities, to define nations as ways to justify decisions that were made.
So how does historical memory get distinguished from history and revisionist history itself, mm-hmm. or any other kind of narrative building?
Yeah, well, revisionist history has a kind of connotation about it that individuals are coming along and seeking to change history in some way, shape, or form. But even more importantly, revisionist history seems to address whether or not there's an official story or conventional wisdom. Historical memory recognizes that history changes all the time, and individuals' understandings of history will change all the time. And its linkages to individual memory, frequently when we speak of historical memory, we speak of it in the context of trauma and collectively or national coming to grips with trauma, which certainly has a relationship with history, but it's not the same endeavor.
Alex Hinton.
You know, I've thought a lot about this question, particularly in the context of Cambodia, where I've been doing a lot of research. The Cambodian case really illustrates this clearly. When the Khmer Rouge came to power in 1975, after a civil war, they immediately came in and tried to rewrite the history of the country in terms of their revolutionary struggle. As they did this, they attempted to erase all vestiges of what they called privativism, more capitalism, imperialism. I mean, that got written into their narrative, but they also did erasure, so they got rid of Buddhism, they got rid of the former elite classes. As they did this, and of course, education itself was a key focus. Khmer Rouge were deposed in 1979. Another group that had been effectively, many of their leaders had been purged, came back to power with the support of the Vietnamese. They then rewrote the state-level history to say that, in fact, they were the true heirs of the revolutionary mantle, and they legitimated themselves by saying that they had overthrown the Khmer Rouge, who had perpetrated genocide. In 1993, there was an election in Cambodia. At that point, the international community came back in, and literally, again, sort of focusing on education in the schools, whereas from 1979 to 1991, 1992, the government had intensively focused upon the genocide in their educational materials, including having kids learn to read and write by reading about mass murder. Suddenly it was erased in the name of reconciliation. This phase went on for another 6-7 years, and then in 1997, you began to get people after the Khmer Rouge had started to defect and fall apart. And we're now in a new moment of a tribunal, which is, again, rewriting history, rethinking about it. One of the mechanisms is through in a hybrid international tribunal. But I would just add one other point in terms of history, memory, and nation. we're also writing history on the international level. There's diaspora memory. There's a memory that's created and generated by things like international tribunals, and these may diverge from and both from different groups and sectors in the society and from particular individuals, and there may be multiple narratives that are competing.
Alex Hinton, there was something in your book that I'd like for you to just quickly address that relates to this, but it had to do with the indigenous Maya. And there was a commission hearing for historical clarification. Then you noted with your co-author that people began there to view it as a genocide.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something, the sort of politics of the use of the word genocide is something that's fought over since it's widely recognized as the crime of crimes. In many respects, the number of cases that have been included under this rubric have been restricted because people often invoke what I call the dilution metaphor, saying, well, if we apply it to too many cases, it dilutes the meaning. But effectively, that's a gatekeeper notion. So, you know, as we're moving through time, it seems to me we're at a moment where a number of genocides that were not recognized are starting to be recognized and talked about. There's work that's been done on, for example, on settler societies. The case in Guatemala certainly speaks to this. So absolutely, you know, this also talks about academic discourses and ways of thinking about the past. But certainly in writing history, you know, if you've suffered from the crime of crimes, that's an important thing and something that should be recognized. Yet there are certainly, through the use of the dilution metaphor, ways in which this isn't recognized. And I would just add that the definition of genocide that was passed by the UN in 1948, the UN Genocide Convention, has a very overly restrictive definition of genocide, restricting it to four groups. And this emphasis on these four groups was based on political bargaining at the UN. Again, this is another way in terms of memory, labeling the past, thinking about the past, that things are written in certain ways, certain groups are included, and certain groups are excluded.
Davila Budrite, let me bring you in. You look at this in Eastern Europe and the occurrences there. Give us what your findings are.
I actually would like very much to build on some things that we already said, and I think in the post-communist context, the concept of genocide actually very much relates to historical memory and also interpretation of historical memory. I'm looking into primarily the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and politics of memory in those three states. And especially in the case of Lithuania, I traced the use of the term genocide to describe repressions and deportations that were carried out during Stalinist regime, that is to say from 1940 to 41 and 1944 to 53. And although this particular phrase, genocide, is not used in Latvia and Estonia, the Lithuanians have been very adamant, not just at the national level, but also internationally, demanding the recognition of suffering during these particular times and saying that what was experienced should be treated as genocide. My findings regarding the use of the term genocide have been that when it comes to the creation of pluralistic memory in society, it has not been a very positive development. That what we see in the case of Lithuania, starting in mid-90s, we see these competing victimhoods. That on one hand, you see Lithuanians who are saying, well, World War II has a very special meaning for us. Post-World War II era also has a very special meaning for us, and we were the victims. We were the real victims, and our genocide was as bad as the Holocaust. And on the other hand, you have international community and also members of Lithuanian Jewish community who are saying, well, you are engaging in the Holocaust obfuscation. You actually are misusing the term genocide. So this is a very, very intense debate. It's not over yet, but it has also been a very polarizing debate as well.
I think we see this a little bit in the Balkan Wars as well, where the idea of what happened in World War II with the victimization of the Serbs then became a historical memory that sort of obfuscated, should we say, the war on the Bosnians, for example. Did you see that as well, Davila?
I think it's a very astute observation, and I've always wanted to sometimes do a comparative study of the Baltics and the Balkans. But absolutely, World War II, especially in the cases of Latvia and Estonia, have a very different meaning to ethnic Russians than to ethnic Latvians and ethnic Estonians. And we see these memory wars recently when the Estonian government decided to move one of the artifacts associated with World War II. And this actually led to almost an international conflict, if you will. So, yes, absolutely, we see similar developments.
Brent Sasley, let's bring you in. I know that one of the areas that you look at are emotions and how these historical memories then evoke these intergroup emotions. Can you explain intergroup emotions and how these are related?
First thing that I guess I would say is also that the thing about collective memories is that they don't just exist, but they get interpreted and reinterpreted by either the same group or different groups of people over time. And so you have this sort of this amorphous thing out there that's this memory, but it gets used for specific purposes. And I don't mean necessarily in sinister ways. Collective memory serves the needs of different groups of people. And we talk a lot about trauma, and that's what most of us have investigated when it comes to trauma and collective memory. And trauma is a very negative, powerful, but a very negative emotion, a very negative event that happens, but it doesn't necessarily have to lead to very negative collective memories. In other words, groups often can use it or can interpret past traumatic events in slightly more positive ways. So, for example, you know, one of the things that I study is the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister. This was just the murder of a single individual. It wasn't a grand traumatic event like a genocide or extended conflict, but yet it was a very traumatic experience for a large segment of the Israeli population. What they then did was use that the legacy, what they called the legacy of Rabin, for political purposes, to promote their ideas of the peace process. And so Rabin, he had this emotional connection to the peace process, and once he was killed, the trauma of his death and his loss was then utilized in sort of a more positive way to bring up these positive emotions, which could then be used for certain policies.
You know, that's interesting. I know that, Doug Becker, you have been looking at the use of leaders to then change public policy. This isn't in the same realm as grief, of course, but one of your areas is looking at this memory creation and almost myth creation, shall we say, of Ronald Reagan. Talk about how that applies here.
Yeah, I think part of it, Brent had just said about how they will create a collective memory to serve some sort of contemporary political purpose. I'd like to put a name on the they. I use Elizabeth Helene's, I think, very powerful notion of a memory entrepreneur. Individuals who are responsible for creation of memory, for reinterpretation of memory, and specifically what those purposes are. You see that in traumatic cases, you see that in cases of grief, but you also see it in the kind of triumphal cases, like in the Reagan Legacy Project. I've been particularly interested in the number of things that have been named after Ronald Reagan over the course of the last 10 to 15 years. And my interest in memory entrepreneurship, it's rare that you can identify a single individual who's serving as the role of memory entrepreneur, but that single individual is Grover Norquist, and his desire is to name at least one thing after Ronald Reagan in every county in America. That's over 3,100 counties, by the way. But it's this sort of soundbite memory without a great deal of context. You name enough things after the president, and people will presume his greatness, which then opens the door for any individual to strategically use that memory for their own purposes, whether it be Ronald Reagan would have invaded Iraq. Therefore, a neo-Reaganite foreign policy of that would follow this great president must support a war in Iraq. I've heard Reagan certainly invoked in the air war in Libya because of the airstrikes over Libya. Whether or not Reagan would have chosen that policy is actually unimportant at this point. That Reagan is considered great because so many things are named after him allows individuals to strategically use his name for whatever policy they choose. And I'd like to point out, of course, Reagan is not the only president where this is used. It's frequently used in connection with John Kennedy as well. Kennedy would have chosen this policy, therefore we must choose it as well, or at least it's justified.
Yeah, if I could just add something to that, Brent Sasley.
Yes.
People have certain visualizations of these events, and they visualize the memory in specific ways. And so the idea that Reagan was this great president, they visualize what he did and how he did it, and so naming certain things after him is a way of emphasizing or stressing his legacy. And so just, you know, the counterpart to that would be Rabin. You know, Rabin was a very violent man. I mean, he was a leader in the Israeli pre-state military for a long time. He was a major figure in many of Israel's early wars. But yet his legacy is that of a peacemaker. he was visualized not as this violent man, but he was visualized as this person who, you know, sacrificed everything just to make peace, a very positive kind of thing. And so how groups will visualize individuals or events matters very much for how they interpret and promote those kinds of things.
I'd like to check with our other two scholars who've been quiet for a bit. Mm-hmm. Alex Hinton, let's bring you back in and talk about how these collective memories and historical memory are used to propel these particular things forward, particular policies, especially, well, I guess it would be both domestic and foreign policy. How have you seen that?
Yeah, you know, I guess I have a slightly different approach as an anthropologist in terms of memory and also one who's interested in psychological anthropology. But, you know, I'm always wary of speaking about memory, collective memory, as sort of a monolithic thing that somehow is linked to something like emotion or some type of ritualization. It's a dynamic process. There's a huge amount of individual variation. And what I would argue is that, in fact, it's very difficult to use collective memory to achieve a certain end. In fact, it takes a great amount of work. People are not simpletons. They think about issues. And again, on, you know, someone like Reagan, I think you always have to link it directly to existing institutional structures and existing social practices. So these things are not static. They're dynamic through time. I think it's always important to keep in mind that for every collective memory that somehow is meaningful to people, there are a lot of dead memories that are out there, attempts to forge a collective memory that haven't worked. But there are also attempts to forge a memory that haven't worked at a certain time that later in time can come and have resonance with people, depending on the context. To sort of think about memory, I think it's always important to keep in mind the social context, the individuals within and groups within those contexts that are dynamic and active and creative thinkers.
Davile Buduce?
My approach has been primarily looking at memory entrepreneurs and how memories are used, not just at the national level, but also at the international level. And in the case of the Baltic states, and not just the Baltic states, but also other East European countries, recently we saw an attempt to try to criminalize the denial of crimes perpetrated by communist regimes at the European level. Again, it's a very interesting endeavor in that particular sense that you actually have many of the former victims who are using their traumatic experiences as political points to say that this actually should affect the foreign policy of their countries. So in this particular case, I guess my approach would be different from the anthropological approach. I definitely would agree that social context matters greatly. However, I think that it's worthwhile to focus on individuals who very often are the members of elites and who are able to instrumentalize the experiences and often awaken even those dead memories.
Doug Becker, let's bring you back in because in terms of this whole process, you and I have spoken a bit about what's happened in Rwanda and specifically about Paul Kagame. Tell our listeners about what your observations are there.
When thinking about memory entrepreneurship, Rwanda is a fascinating case because, of course, in 1994, a genocide was perpetrated against the Tutsi by the majority Hutu. And that genocide only ended with Kagame's Rwandan Patriotic Front seizing the...
So back up to saying Paul Kagame was the leader right. of a rebel group called the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
Right. That attacked Rwanda. Actually had been in the war with the Rwandan government prior to that. But his successful capturing of the Rwandan capital of Kigali, in essence, it's been interpreted as it ends the genocide. In reality, the genocide continues, but it continues in Zaire, what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But Kagame understood the power of the narrative that he ended the genocide. First of all, with a rush to memorialization, an issue that currently is gaining a great deal of resonance in Rwanda, in this desire to freeze the memory with these memorials, that it was an asymmetry of violence. To be Tutsi meant to be the victim of a genocide. To be Hutu means to be a perpetrator of the genocide. Now, that part of the story, of course, is correct, but there continues to be violence in eastern Congo, where because of reprisal killings as well as some other, certainly some local conditions that lead to what we believe to be upwards of around 200,000 Hutu who end up being killed in the Congolese Civil War. Kagame has wielded his savior status to blunt any UN attempt to meaningfully investigate in eastern Congo, in part because the UN didn't intervene to help the Tutsi in 1994, so therefore delegitimizing the UN in investigating what could be some level of complicity on his part in the violence against the Hutu. So in that case, it becomes an example, what I would call sort of a more of an ontological definition of policy, where once an actor, a state, a society, a civilization, a nation becomes defined, then the actions they take underneath it also take a certain definition. If you're a victim of a genocide, you cannot commit a genocide. You cannot commit atrocities.
Or that's so the interpretation.
That's the argument that gets leveled. And so that's why these meanings have such powerful potency, both at the national and the international level. And anyone who would criticize Kagame,
like victims can do no harm kind of a thing.
Right. Or
like
at least
we are the role of the victim, therefore we could not have possibly done something bad.
You know, absolutely. And then international criticism of such a policy evokes a kind of memory that, oh, you must have supported the Hutu during the genocide, or at least did nothing about the genocide. You have no moral authority by which to criticize me. I'm the one that saved the country from a genocide. And I'd be very curious, Alex, with your work in Cambodia, if Hun Sen's been doing some similar types of policies.
Alex Hinton?
Sure. No, thanks for the question. I might also, you know, also to speak about Rwanda briefly, that again, I think that's a very clear example where someone comes to power and they attempt to forge a collective memory. They have different ways institutionally, from memorialization, commemoration, to attempt to assert that memory. But within Rwanda, if you go on the ground level, you know, people studying on the ground level have seen how different individuals negotiate this in very different ways. In addition, you know, if you look at, they had Gacaca trials, which were sort of a state level attempt to take a ritual that existed in Rwanda, reformulate it somewhat, and then put a lot of the people, they were over 100,000 people were in jail, to try them in these local courts. And if you actually pay attention to the Gacacas and watch what's said and done, there's all sorts of things that are going on that subvert the state-level narrative, that question it. You know, people will also tell you things in public that are very different from what they'll tell you in private. So again, all of these contexts are absolutely critical. What we see from afar is the collective memory, the thing the state's doing. It's only when you're on the ground talking to people that you can begin to see this variation, this sort of dynamic process that's on the ground. In Cambodia, it's, you know, exactly the same thing, where, again, if you looked at Hun Sen or the PRK regime, the regime that was in power from 79 to 93, they said they asserted a collective memory, and they tried to institutionalize it through commemoration, through memory, through putting in the educational text. But there was a lot of variation on the local level, and people resisted in different sorts of ways. Absolutely critical to keep in mind that people aren't passive receptors of what's done by the state. People, they can be creative in thinking, and they can resist in different ways. And what we see from our vantage is often very different from what's going on the ground level, and I can't stress that point enough.
So there are these competing experiences that people have, and one of them gets disseminated as the truth, is what it sounds like part of the battle is. So memory itself becomes a battleground.
Yeah, it is. But different people have different abilities to control the memory, in the sense of having control of state-level institutions that can try to ritualize, enact, and promote that vision. So different accounts can have different degrees of voice. And if you look through time, though, what's fascinating is you see certain accounts that may be the predominant one on the state level shift, go out, new ones come in at different times. There may be a plurality of them. They may be contested and negotiated at a different moment in time. But again, it's easy to see something as static and assume that's sort of the collective memory there, and the people primarily sort of believe that. It's much more complicated to go on the ground level and watch how these processes proceed through time, and to, again, pay attention to the people and the groups who may be resisting or have their own private networks that are not in accordance with that state-level narrative.
Davila Budute, let's bring you back in, and then let's bring Brent Sasley back in right after you. Give us some specific examples about how you have seen this memory entrepreneurship actually resulting in some kind of a policy that would not have happened, or some kind of a political outcome that would not have happened potentially without it.
Yeah, sure. I will be glad to do that. But if I could also add a little bit on pluralistic memory, and one of the findings from a recent project that I've been working on is that if a state, especially in a democratizing state, if it tries to impose one particular memory on the populace, what happens is that those pluralistic memories that are alternative to the state-imposed memory, they actually become stronger and they assert themselves. Myself, I actually did some on-ground work with women politicians,
the memory entrepreneurs, and some of the policies that they have been focusing on was history education. To give a specific example, one of the leading politicians in Lithuania, she said that probably one of the most depressing things for her is the fact that the Lithuanian children can name, and it's still true today, 20 years after the independence, it would be much easier to name a Soviet partisan than to name actually an anti-Soviet resistance fighter. So it was one of the most traumatic things for her that her version of memory is still not the most popular type of memory. So her big project would be with history education. And interestingly, this is also something that the Lithuanian Commission, Historical Commission, focuses primarily on education, and they try to do both genocide education and also education of the Soviet crimes.
Brent Sasley.
I mean, I think it makes sense to talk about a hegemonic interpretation of an event or hegemonic control over a collective memory, but we also need to think about it, and this kind of answers the first question you asked me, which I didn't really answer. But when you talk about group emotions or collective emotions, really we have to identify first the group that we're talking about and then how group members identify. One can speak about a nation or you know, a national collective memory. Not every single person within that national unit necessarily identifies either with the state or with that memory. People who are high identifiers or who see themselves as part of that group are more likely to remember something in a specific way. And certainly there are contests over that, but once you've defined your group and people have this shared emotional reaction to something, you know, then they start to see events and objects and other groups. When they impact on the group, that's when they get these reactions, and then that's where the collective memory can also be brought in. So again, in the case of Rabin, you know, there were a number of different ways to interpret him and his actions, and he was vilified by the right wing in Israel. He was, you know, hated by many people on the right. But once he was assassinated, and this is where, you know, the context does certainly become relevant, a certain segment of the Israeli population, that is the left, was able to interpret his memory in a very different way because there was much more freedom for them to be able to do so. Now, not everybody believed in Rabin that way, and they didn't perceive him in that way. People still didn't like him or they disagreed with him. But the context didn't allow them to really challenge that, what became the hegemonic interpretation, at least for that time. That's starting to change now as that legacy or that memory is starting to decline in the context of the continuation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, lack of resolution, and so on. But I think, you know, defining the group that you're talking about and speaking about how members identify with that group is also important.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but I'd like to thank all four of you. This has been really quite interesting and something that I think I've never heard on the air before. So I hope that it is very enlightening for our listeners. So let me thank each of you individually. Alex Hinton, thank you.
Thank you.
Brent Sasley, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dovile Budrite, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Doug Becker.
Thank you, Marie.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also, special thanks to Ishmael Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of this show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armudian.com. See you next week.